To start the podcast, could you say a little bit about your experiences of using digital technology as an academic?
So I started blogging about 6 years ago, and the blog kind of forms the main part of my digital identity, I guess. But then from there, you tend to go off and experiment with lots of other things. So, you know, all the usual stuff, Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and SlideShare, all those kind of things. And really, I started using the blog as a way of exploring the impact of new technologies upon higher education practice, really. And to give me a kind of a space to do that in that was kind of outside of formal publications, really, which I felt was important.
And how do you think that digital technology is changing higher education practice?
It's a good question. I think there's a kind of tension at the moment. There was a big load of studies that were done last year, a few years ago, looking at researchers' use of new technology. And they kind of all came to the same conclusion, which was basically researchers are quite risk averse in this stuff. And they proposed a number of reasons why that might be the case. So I think on the one hand, there's kind of lots of innovation happening. If you kind of look on the small scale, people are doing really interesting things and there's a real kind of potential to do different things. But on the other hand, that they're operating within quite a conservative context, if you like. So for instance, it's difficult to get blogs and those kind of things recognised for formal publication or formal promotion cases and stuff like that. So on the one hand, there's this high potential and for reuse and adapting what we do and changing our approach to research and teaching and public engagement. But at the same time, it's operating within a very kind of conservative environment, which often tries to reinforce traditional practices such as the peer-reviewed journal article published in a recognised impact journal and those kind of things. So it's a kind of a mixed picture. And I think in some ways that's what makes it very interesting. We're a kind of a crucial time, I think, for academics in higher education. We're seeing that change happen before us, and how those battles play out over the next few years will be key, I think.
As individuals innovate, but structures stifle that innovation.
Yeah, it's a strange process. I mean, if you think of other industries, often when they get new blood in, they kind of they recognise those are the people who come with new ideas. But what a lot of these studies found was that new staff, new researchers or new teachers were kind of more or less told, don't waste your time on all that other nonsense like blogging and, you know, having an online identity. Concentrate on getting publications in the accepted peer-reviewed journals. So in some ways, we kind of get all this new blood in and then stifle any form of innovation that they might bring to our sector, which I think perhaps it's a too strong word, but it's just quite a dangerous situation for us to be in as a sector. We're kind of stifling and the new ideas and the innovation that we might get from the new blood that enters our sector.
Do you think that these technologies have consequences for what it is to be a scholar and what scholarly activity entails?
Yes and no. I mean, it depends on how you want to define scholarship. And I think what happens is that we've quite often thought of what it means to be a scholar in terms of the physical things that we produce. And we haven't realised we're making that assumption. So we tend to think of, you know, the research journal article as the output of research, and that acts as a proxy for saying someone's a good researcher. But we haven't really that isn't the reason we have a journal article that's kind of a certain length and are published in journals so often, are really because of the demands of the print industry. And we kind of have an opportunity to rethink what we mean by research. So an example I often give is my colleague Tony Hurst keeps a blog, O Useful Info, and he likes to pan around with open data and open tools. And so on any one day, you might find some open data, put it through a visualization tool, test the connections between people in something like Twitter and see how those people are connected or are sharing certain patterns and things, and engage and just answer a very small research question for himself. So if you looked at that, his blog over a period of time, it would constitute a research process, you know, investigating, trying to find new ideas and uncover kind of different elements of knowledge, but it wouldn't be recognised as research in our traditional sense. So in some ways, I think it challenges what we mean by a lot of our traditional definitions of things such as research, teaching, public engagement. But in other ways, it's just alternative tools to do things we've always done. You know, that is one perspective.
But the nature of the tools means that the widespread uptake could ultimately transform what it is we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's not a case of... the thing I often try to say to people is, it's not a case of this thing is dead and it's now been replaced by this. It's just a case of we have more alternatives now. So, for instance, I wouldn't say that we need to get rid of the peer-reviewed journal article. That forms a certain part of academic discourse, and it's worth keeping that. But if you want to get an idea out previously, then the only thing you had open to you were a conference paper or a journal article, really. But now there's so many other options. For example, you can write a blog post, you can produce a video, you can do a podcast or whatever. So suddenly we've got a wide range of alternatives available to us, where beforehand there was a kind of monopoly on how we conduct practice. So two things are happening. One is you've kind of got a richer range, a richer toolbox to choose from. But secondly, and without kind of going down a technology deterministic approach, having those things begins to influence your own practice. So, for instance, in order to keep a global network of peers beforehand, I probably would have to be on the keynote circuit and spend all my time traveling around conferences, talking to people and maintaining a kind of physical network. And now, through social networks and blogs and so on, I've got a very good online global network of peers, and I don't need to leave my desk for that. So the way we begin to collaborate changes, and what we think is a kind of academic connection or a collaboration or a research project is beginning to be altered by the types of connections we have with each other.
Is there something potentially subversive about that in terms of the autonomy of research networks vis-a-vis institutions? Because, for instance, in that conference circuit example, the academic in question is probably dependent on research, on their research budget from their department to be able to travel the world like that.
Yeah, I think that there might be some of that. Suddenly we start questioning, why are you always travelling? Why are you always in conferences in Hawaii when you could just be talking online to these people? And again, I don't want to say that we get rid of all face-to-face conferences. You know, they still form a vital part of I think, what you do and what constitutes academic practice. But it is the case that you'll be able to do different things. And so subversive is an interesting term. In some ways, I think it might democratize it, because there's a certain element of, not intended, but kind of almost by accident, you get a certain element of elitism occurs, because not everyone can travel around these conferences all the time. But online, you're as good as your identity, you're as good as your last blog post, and you can connect to people. And it's a much kind of flatter, more democratized space. You don't really care about someone's institutional reputation. So whether they're the kind of ed tech support guy or the professor, it doesn't really make any difference in an online context. So in some ways, I think it's a much more kind of democratized space, and that could well be subversive, I guess.
But is there a widespread fear that those hierarchies, even if they were sometimes inadvertently elitist, functioned as ciphers of quality, as ciphers for quality, and prestige might be lost?
Yeah, the quality issue is a big one. So when anyone can publish anything, then inevitably you get kind of lots of dross in that. And so David Weinberger has this phrase, and we're moving from a process where we used to filter on the way in to filter on the way out now. So your social network becomes very important. So if there are people in your social network who you trust and have got a good reputation within that network and how they're well connected, then if they link to something, or if they keep a collection of on Delicious or Scoop or whatever, then you tend to trust their judgment. So they're acting as a filter for you. So there's no kind of guaranteed quality thing, which is what the academic journal used to provide. No, this has been through a process of quality assurance. You can more or less trust what it says. But now anyone can blog anything. So you need to become, there's a kind of certain buyer beware attitude. You need to be able to assess quality. And we need to learn different ways of doing that, both assessing the quality of what the person's saying and of their own reputation within the network, which is why it's so difficult for us to start recognising things such as blogs and online identity in terms of promotion and recognition, because we know what a good publication record looks like. We can say that's a good journal, they've published there, but we don't really know what a good blogging record looks like. You know, you could get loads of hits on your blog, but that's because you're blogging about Paris Hilton or something, so which is kind of nothing academic. So being able to recognise and judge that quality will be a more difficult and complex process.
What do you think needs to take place before we can start to develop communal standards by which to assess social media outputs?
I would be quite wary of standards. I think what you don't want to do is get into a game playing routine where, you know, if you get a Technorati rating of 100, then you get promoted to senior lecturer, you know, because that would just kind of reinforce kind of a very kind of negative approach to it.
You don't want to reduplicate the ref on the internet.
Exactly, yeah. All you do is end up kind of playing to the game and it's the whole thing. And so it changes people's behaviour. I think what we will need, but you can certainly put in place lots of guidelines, and you've seen this a lot, particularly digital humanities people are beginning to recognise this. So the idea you bring back in lots of peer reviews, you have trusted people, and you say, well, can you look at this and say, do you think this is a good quality track record in this field? And there may be some use of metrics in there as well, but I think combined with a kind of a human factor, so you may be able to use metrics in terms of just some of the data, you like number of hits, kind of how well connected they are within their network and stuff. So the example I would give is really about a reputation and impact within your network. So if your expertise is medieval dance, you know, it's probably not going to be a well-read blog. So the absolute number of hits isn't important. It's not that you're not going to be competing with kind of world-famous bloggers like Scoble or somebody, but what you want to be able to demonstrate is that within your subject discipline of medieval dance, yours is the kind of well-recognized blog. So it might only have, you know, 2,000 views a month, but actually those 2,000 views are of all the people who are interested in medieval dance. So it's been able to represent that kind of impact and reputation that I think we need to work on.
And so those standards almost emerge from communities of practice, if we can network those communities of practice adequately.
Yeah, and I think having formal peer review process will be important. I think you can do so much with metrics and measures, but they only form one part of the picture, really. So it's a kind of a more holistic picture you need to gather.
And what consequences do you think these changes have for scholarly publishing, particularly the commercial end of it?
Oh, there is the question. As you probably know, so the open access movement has kind of grown a lot, and so we're seeing a number of funders saying that if we're going to fund your research, then the outputs of it need to be made openly available and not behind firewalls or paywalls with publishers. And that obviously represents a challenge for publishers, because that's how they made their money, by selling subscriptions back to the libraries. So a lot of them say that there's what's called the gold route for open access publishing, so you can pay for your article to be published to make open access. But that galls at people as well. But there are a number of tools, for instance, the Open Journal System, OJS, which allow you to kind of set up and run a journal system fairly cheaply and freely, that the kind of cost is in doing some of the admin and chasing. So I think you'll see, well, we are seeing a lot more open access online journals, particularly from kind of professional societies where they can run a journal with fairly low overheads. It's rarely free. But so I think you will see a big challenge to the publisher's models. We saw, for instance, only last week, Harvard saying that it can't afford to pay the subscription fees that people like Elsevier are demanding. So it's always been a very strange model. You know, academics write all the content, they do the reviewing, they kind of manage the process of, you know, the editor of the journal being academic, and there is some work done in terms of copy editing and that by the publishers. And then they sell it back to the very same institutions who produce the content for free, and that's a strange model to sell to anyone, I think, really.
And so there's a need for scholarly publishers to redefine their role and the value they add to the process.
Yeah, and it's beginning to feel a slightly antagonistic relationship at the moment. You know, that they're feeling kind of embattled by it, you know, and they need to dig in and find, and so they're trying to lock down stuff. And others are kind of working more closely with academics, and academics are beginning to feel, you know, I think what happens once you could see online open access journals, people kind of thought, yeah, what? It made you question the whole process, really, which they'd never done before. So it raised a number of questions. But I think that there are things that journals can do, and the gold rule, I think, will work. So you see it working very well with things like PLOS, Public Library of Science. And what they can offer then is a lot more, they can offer kind of richer services, so things that they can give you analytics, you know, on how many people are accessing your article and where it's being talked about on Twitter or whatever, and they can do a lot more promotion for you, and you're within a certain kind of community of practice there. So they can offer quite a good deal, I think. And it's, I think what you'll see is almost like a compare the market type thing for journals. That, well, I can publish here for free with this kind of online journal run by a small society, but they don't offer all these additional services. Or I can publish over here and pay $3,000, which is fine if I've got a research grant, and they'll offer me these additional services and get this kind of impact. So they'd be able to offer a range of services, I think, and you can, as the author, you probably pick and choose between those.
Because I find it very exciting that, you know, in all areas, these digital tools are lowering the costs involved in experimentation and innovation. But for individual universities, even if the structures like the REF are not going to go anytime soon, can individual institutions do things to support digital innovation?
Yeah, I think it's a question they're kind of asking themselves. Is, I think universities are coming around to accepting that they want their academics to kind of have a digital profile, you know, for a number of reasons. I think students themselves or potential students often look at university and sort of see who are the high profile people online, and that's part of the university's reputation. In order to be able to engage with those students, you know, they need people who kind of understand this technology and this way of communicating, I think. And there are kind of efficiencies to be made by using open educational resources or whatever. So I think universities are beginning to come around to the picture that it's a worthwhile thing for them. And I think you can put in place a kind of top-down and bottom-up approach from universities. You can have kind of quite institutional projects. So, for instance, at the Open University, we've got things like Open Learn, where we're releasing open educational resources. And that kind of sends a message that we take open education seriously, and, you know, there's a route for you to put content out there. But also there's a kind of bottom-up approach you can facilitate where, for instance, by recognising digital outputs in terms of promotion. And we've also, at the AU, for instance, we've got something called Oro, which is an online repository. And that was just for journal articles, published articles, but we're kind of broadening out there to include other types of scholarships. So you'd be able to put in a slideshare presentation, for instance. And that in itself just sends a message that, you know, we recognise these as other forms of worthy scholarly activity. So I think you can combine those two approaches, and hopefully it's never going to be everyone, but you're beginning to say to people, you know, this type of activity is worth engaging in, and it's something that we respect and acknowledge.
Earlier in the podcast, you mentioned the studies that found that, for instance, early career researchers are being told that they should not focus on this digital stuff and get on with the day-to-day business of building their careers. Do you think this sort of these sorts of digital infrastructure projects help make it easier for people earlier in their careers to manage competing pressures?
Yeah, I think people early in their careers are kind of damned if they do and damned if they don't. Because really, as an early career researcher now, it would also be quite dangerous to ignore all the new digital tools. You know, you really do need to be building up a good digital identity. Because there's been also lots of studies that show that, you know, people with a good online network tend to get their papers cited more. So first of all, if you publish in open access, your paper gets found more and cited more, at least viewed more. And secondly, if you have a decent Twitter or blog network, then if you tweet papers, they tend to get cited more as well. So you can't really afford to ignore it as an early career researcher. You kind of need to build up that identity. But at the same time, it's not so well advanced. You can just do that at the expense of the kind of traditional publications. So you need to keep a foot in both camps. But I don't really see them as necessarily in competition with each other. And I think those examples of helping the citations being helped by your online network is an example where they're kind of really complementary. And I think it's a mistake to view engaging in online stuff as an additional task or something that takes more time. I think it takes a bit of time to get some momentum going. But often, once you're established, it's a very efficient way of working. So, for example, when I was writing my book, The Digital Scholar, which I wrote last year, I compared it with when I wrote my previous book, which was in 2005, I think, and how much the social network had changed over that time and how much it had become an important part of my writing. So I would put out a call, for instance, saying, has anyone got experience of X? And people would come back to me saying, yeah, have you read this or we've done this? And so I could use my social network as a really kind of efficient information filter. And because people knew I was writing the book, they would often just tweet me a link to something, put CC and Weller at the end because they knew I'd be interested in it. So information was coming to me without me having to go out to it. So in that sense, having the social network and online identity saved me time. So once it's established, it's not really an extra cost to what you do.
And to bring the podcast to a close, and I apologise because this is a very big question, but what do you think an Academy of Network Digital Scholars would look like? How would it differ from what we see around us today?
I think that you could come up with a very radical view of that, and you know, kind of space age view. We'll look, you know, we won't be working in the same places. We'll all be distributed and operating online. So I could give you a view like that, but I think it will tend to be more realistic, quite not dissimilar to how it is now, but just it's the way the stuff impacts in quite small ways upon your working practice. So I think when new technologies come along, we kind of get carried away with them, and I know lots of people, and when the first time they're on Facebook or Twitter, they kind of become addicted to it, and you feel like you have to tweet and let everyone know about everything. But what's more interesting is once you've gone past that kind of initial burst of enthusiasm is how it settles into your normal pattern of working. So I think that kind of, if you had a fairly well-connected university with kind of digital scholars working across all disciplines, you'd still have your face-to-face meetings and stuff, and you'd still go to your face-to-face conferences. But at the same time, you would have a mix in there that people would have a good online identity. They would connect in many different ways. And they would, I think that they'd develop different voices as well. So they would know how to write academic papers, but at the same time, be well-versed in communicating online and developing different skills. So the types of skills that might become important are knowing how to create good videos that, for instance, might drive people to your research project. Being familiar with analytics, so you can say, you know, who's looking at our material, and you know, what kind of bounce rate do we expect? Those kind of things. Being good at curation and filtering, you might be the trusted person to go to who kind of reads around the subject and gathers all that stuff together. Being good at networking and writing for an online audience. Those are kind of quite different skills. I think we'll see those type of skills becoming increasingly important. And it's not the case that everyone's going to have all of them, but you'll know people who are very good at those particular things. So, for instance, I've got a colleague who's very good at live blogging at a conference, and that's a particular skill, you know, which wasn't around, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, but it's really useful to have. And so I start trying to invite that person along to talks because I know they'll give a really good account of it. And so you might have other people, you'll say, you know, can you join our research projects? Just because we know you've got a really good online network that can disseminate the information through that network. So I think you'll see subtle changes, but kind of on a first glance, it wouldn't look too dissimilar to current practice. But actually, when you observed closely, you would see that people are operating in quite different ways.
Thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome.